Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome, and thank you all for joining this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to both CRE newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director at CREXI. And today, we are thrilled to sit down with Ari Robbie, EVP of Investment Sales at RIPCO. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Ari Robbie joined RIPCO Real Estate Services in December of 2022 with a focus on investment sales for multi-tenant and single-tenant assets. Ari entered the commercial real estate industry with Commercial Real Estate Florida in 2008, specializing in sales and leasing for office and retail buildings in the Tampa Bay MSA. From 2013 to 2019 at Marcus & Millichap, Ari was an investment sales agent before moving into a regional manager position overseeing the Tampa office until 2019, where he experienced revenue growth every year. In 2019, Ari joined CBRE, where he specialized in investment sales with a focus on multi- and single-tenant retail and office assets. During his tenure at CBRE, he closed approximately $200 million in transaction volume. Ari received his bachelor's degree from the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business. Previously, he attended Berkeley Preparatory School in Tampa. Ari, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ashley. Appreciate it.
Of course, we are so thrilled to sit down with you today. Of course, we just went over an extensive background for you for our listeners, but I'd love to learn more about your career path and lessons learned along the way. So first and foremost, where did you grow up and how did you get your start in commercial real estate?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in the Tampa area. So I grew up here, went off to Gainesville for college for about 4.5 years. And during that time, I found this summer sales job my junior summer, where I went to a different part of the country and sold educational reference books door to door on straight commission. First summer was the suburbs of Detroit. Second summer was the suburbs of Pittsburgh, working 80, 90, 100-hour weeks just by yourself for 13 weeks. But that's when I really realized that sales was something that I found a way to enjoy and was good at and decided to go down that career path. But I graduated in 02. Didn't think about real estate at the time. Had a couple sales jobs where I achieved success but didn't achieve enjoyment and fulfillment. So I had a couple of buddies that were in the real estate industry. Some were brokers, some were on the principal side. And every time I'd go out with them at night, we'd go drinking, we'd be talking about real estate. And I figured, if I was having a good time talking about real estate while I was out with my buddies drinking, I might as well try to make a career out of it. So in 06, I started with a small development firm, went away from the sales side, realized that I needed to go back to that. In real estate especially. So in 08, that's when I started at Prudential Commercial Real Estate and the leasing world and some small sales. And you just read the rest of my biography. That's what I've been doing ever since.
I love it. I really truly love when people say that they did door-to-door sales. I think that just builds such a foundation for anything. I personally, when I graduated college the summer before I went into, or excuse me, when I graduated high school the summer before I went into college, I sold Cutco knives. I don't know if you guys know about that, but it was my intro into sales and it was door to door, calling up all your friends and family and hitting them up and doing the in-person, demonstrations and things like that. And it just builds a different type of seller. So I appreciate that start. When you got into the sector of real estate, you figured out, hey, this is what I want to do. I have fun talking about this, and this is really where I'm passionate about. What was the area of focus, and how did you get into the niche of, kind of more investment sales?
Sure. So my first 5 years in brokerage, as I told you, I was in leasing with a smaller platform, Prudential, which is a small franchise. Great people, of which I'm still very close friends with a lot of them today. Learned a ton. Wouldn't be where I am without them. But I had an interest in focusing more on investment sales. From my standpoint, I thought it'd be more enjoyable, something I'd be good at, and larger income potential, which is why I joined Marks & Millichap in 2013. I joined them because great sales training is one of their many reputations, almost all good, and thought I'd want to go to that type of platform because just in my history of sales and life experience, training, coaching, teaching, mentorship was integral to accelerate time frame of success. So that's why I switched from leasing into sales. Although I did realize when I joined CBRE, I mean, income potential on the leasing side is exponential as well. So I just wasn't exposed to it my first 5 years because I was working in a smaller market, working on smaller stuff. But that's why I focus on investment sales and have zero regrets.
I love to hear that. And you kind of segued into another topic that I wanted to talk about for a lot of folks on this podcast listening in or just trying to look for different firms to join. Training and mentorship is hugely important. So what were maybe some early lessons that you learned in your career, whether it was at door-to-door sales, whether it was at Prudential or Marcus or wherever it was, what were some really big lessons that you learned early on that kind of shaped your career?
Sure. Good question. So what I learned, in addition to how important training, coaching, teaching, and mentorship is there's very few people out there that are really good at both. And sometimes a misconception is if someone's a phenomenal agent and can transact a deal better than anyone else, that doesn't necessarily make them good mentors, coaches, and teachers. So that's a lot of what I've learned over the years. And also when it comes to training, it, for me at least, a structured, organized training program was very important to me because the way my brain thinks is I can be very creative, I can be very emotional, I have a lot of skill sets and great attributes, in my opinion, not trying to sound full.
We know. But, they're all great.
But that type of structure and framework created a scenario for me visually in my head that was a lot easier to navigate. So when Marks & Millichap especially, they're unbelievable at that. They are very good at, if you have the skill set, they will run you through the process, create an environment that's uncomfortable at all times, because with that, with comfort comes stagnation. So with discomfort comes growth, if you want to apply it. So that's what they had. That was a perfect scenario and environment for me to be in at that time. And I couldn't be more grateful. And by the way, so one of my most important mentors in my career in life is a guy that hired me at Marks & Millichap named Richard Matricaria. He's actually the COO of the Western part of the US now. So he's done a very good job really advancing his career. And it's no surprise because he was one of those rare human beings. I was a super high level agent, but a phenomenal mentor, teacher, and coach because he had the disposition and mindset to be able to teach with patience, yet discipline, combined with a track record of understanding the nuances of all transactions and doing it himself, which is rare in this world.
I love that. And I couldn't agree more. I think that sometimes the best sellers do have a hard time, mentoring people or teaching, right? Especially as an adult, you learn in different aspects. So understanding that process, and obviously Marcus and probably other companies out there spend an extensive time researching how adults learn and how we need to, train people, but then let someone else do that and kind of let them fail almost, right? Versus stepping in and just trying to do the deal for you, right? Because you can have someone, on your team and do the deal for you, but then you really learn when you're doing it yourself and kind of having that ability to fail, which is really hard as a mentor, but then I think that's the biggest way to learn. So going on that topic, do you have any favorite mistakes, Ari, that has, you know, allowed you to potentially pivot or course correct or taught you something along the way that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah. Before I get into that, though, you hit on a good point about failure. So good mentors encourage failure. Not hard for good mentors to prevent their mentees or whoever they're advising to fail. That's an attribute that would make a mentor not very good to do it themselves.
Yep.
Yep. So 100%. Great point, and couldn't agree with you more. So yeah, there's a lot of things I've learned and have adjusted over the years. And one of those is I have a pretty strong personality. And back in my 20s, I loved arguing. I loved being right. And, you know, that started with my dad, who no matter what side of a fence on a discussion I took, he took the other side. And after those discussions, he would always say, hey, look, I agreed with you sometimes. He goes, I agreed with you from the beginning. But until you can put yourself in someone else's shoes, understand where they're coming from and have the elasticity in your brain to be able to change the way you think, even if it wasn't your opinion in the beginning, that's going to be unbelievably important in life. So I bonded with him by arguing, and we got a lot of fulfillment and joy out of it. And then I came to realize that I'm in the minority when it comes to that. Every time I was arguing and wanting to be right and also pick someone else's brain and influence them, more times than not, they weren't enjoying that process, even though I was. So similar early on in my career, there was a couple who I was selling a property for in 2014. And we were under contract. Buyer asked for a legitimate retrade because it was major capital expenses, mainly the roof and part of the structure. And at that time, I wasn't nearly as seasoned and mature as I try to be now and grow every day, but I was right. This is the bottom line, and that was what was in my brain. But it doesn't matter if I was right or wrong, because the message I was trying to deliver wasn't being received, and I got fired. Not only did we not navigate the retrade, but then she fired me. And a year or two later, she had listed it with one of my team members who took my spot when I went to management, and he sold it for her. And she said, at that time, Ari was right. I should have told it a couple of years ago, but it didn't matter. So that was a huge lesson that I learned, was it's not about being right or wrong. It's about figuring out how to deliver the message in a way that the person you're talking to receives it and understands it. So they're in the best possible position to make the decision. She may not have changed her mind. She may not have said yes at that time, but I probably wouldn't have been fired. And it would have been a much more productive conversation if I would have done it correctly and done it with more empathy and understanding versus just being right or wrong. And that was it was a problem, because we live in a gray world, especially brokerage. It's not black and white, it's gray. So right or wrong is black and white. Gray is really trying to deliver that message so people receive it and understand it and in the best possible position to figure out what's best for them. Amongst many other
things, I love that. Yeah, absolutely. I love that lesson. That probably was a hard thing to do and a hard thing to get fired. But the fact that you had just the self-awareness to reflect back on the situation and say, what could I have done differently? How could I have delivered that message differently? And, you know, got it across to that person. That's wonderful. And that's really what we want when we're taking our mistakes into account. It's just that growth mindset and how do we grow. From the arguing back with your father reminds me of, I was doing a debate class in high school, and we were doing a debate on capital punishment, and you had to, you know, argue which side that you wanted to do. And I actually got a C, probably the first C in my life. And I rewrote, I went to the teacher, tried to get a better grade, and rewrote the argument for the opposite side of what I had originally done. And he didn't change my grade, but he said, this is the perfect thing that you needed to do because you weren't arguing your point in the way that it would come across. So very similar aspect is just the delivery and understanding with that empathy that you have to, you know, prove your point, but also take into the other account the other person and how they might feel about it. So it's a huge lesson that you learned, and I love to hear that. I'm sure our listeners do as well. Now, coming into, you know, some of the things for your own personality, what facets of your work ethic or personality traits have contributed most to your success, whether that be on the brokerage side of things, in the individual transactions, or as a leader?
So it all starts with commitment in my mind. So one thing I love about brokerage is you get out what you put in. It's not a 9-to-5 job where you work harder, you're still going to make the same amount, which is something that always resonated with me. So it starts with working harder than the next person, combined with, if you're good, coachable, high level understanding, capable, have a high capacity, then your income potential and the journey that you'll travel to get there is going to be a lot more enjoyable, both internally and externally and financially. So it starts with commitment. I don't know the audience here, whether it's principals or brokers, but from a brokerage standpoint is what I'm talking about, is it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's work sun up to sundown. Some people think I'm imbalanced. I hear about a lot of this work-life balance. And yeah, you know what? I kind of thought about that in my 20s. You know, enjoy my 20s, work hard, do better than most. But what I really learned at Marks & Millichap is what I'm applying now in the past several years is I want an imbalance on the front end so I can do whatever the hell I want on the back end. So when I was a manager in 2015 for a handful of years, I was hiring, developing, training lots and lots of recent college grads. So 23, 24 years old, and working with a lot of 30, 31, 32 year olds that went through that high level of commitment in their 20s. So by the time they got to 29, 30, 31, they were making seven plus figure incomes. And the ones that wanted to make multiple seven figures stayed with that work ethic. But the ones that didn't had the freedom to choose. So they'd come and go as they please, making plenty of money, being smart with that money to build wealth, and having that freedom that I personally want and I'm striving to achieve. So it's that commitment and balance, the work hard versus smart. In my mind, it's rarely or, it's almost always and. And then balance, that work-life balance is, yeah, I may work harder than most now, but the plan is to have the freedom and choice to do what I want later. I have an 8 and 5 year old. I'm always home for them to put them to bed. I'm almost always home after noon or 1 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday to spend time with them, knowing or planning that when they're 11 and 8, 9, whatever the case may be, and they actually need me for even more important things, I'll have that freedom to do what I want when I want. And I'm always there for them anyways. And that goes back to my dad too. My perception of my childhood was he wasn't there because he was working a lot, but he was always there if I needed him. So it was a good balance and dichotomy that he had, where he was highly, highly committed, but would be there at a drop of a hat, dime, whatever the saying is, if I needed him for something important. So it's something I'm trying to emulate here in my life, and something that if I was in my 20s, I wish I would have heard that, because it would have been more likely that it would have resonated and potentially put that foot on the gas sooner than later.
That resonates so well with me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners as well. There was one thing that you said, it's, you know, a lot of people will say work smarter, not harder, right? Well, everyone is trying to do that. I was just listening to Ed Milet. I listened to all of his podcasts, and he has a book out that calls The Power of One More. If you guys haven't checked it out, definitely check it out. It's saying, if I continue to do one more, if I say I'm going to make 20 phone calls today and I do one more, the power of that compounding over time is just going to get you more reps. It's going to get you better, right? So if you have two people in the same token who are, you know, the same skill level, what's going to separate you from them? And that's working hard. And then you have that availability to have the freedom that you want, whether that's financial or to do what you want and to spend more time with your kids or your family. family and things. So that I think is a huge lesson to all of our younger folks, but even still older ones that are listening, you know, just keep doing that every single day and that's going to show up for you. So transitioning into, you know, how you built your team and established RIPCO's Florida team, their expertise, their excellence, obviously that has a lot to do with your skills, your mindset, your growth. But how do you differentiate yourself or your team from other net lease specialists? And can you dive into a little bit of the pros and cons for us on intent specialization?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, you mentioned a book. So there's a book I read about 6 years ago called Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. And I encourage everyone to read. I listen to books, so I've listened to that over and over again over the years, and it really helped shift my mindset and change my mindset. But what I do, you know, another great thing about brokerage is you don't need to be highly, highly intelligent, like a scientist or doctor. You need to work your ass off, and then you need to have some semblance of intelligence, but more importantly, emotional intelligence. So one of the many things that we try to do is, one, work harder than everyone else, and then two, take an advisory mindset. So although we make money transactionally, we want to go away from the transactional mindset and go more towards the advisory mindset. And in my mind, the way I was taught this was advisory is detaching and disconnecting from the outcome. Whether or not they do business with us, whether or not they transact with us, that's okay. Our job is to figure out where they've been with real estate in life, where they are today, where they want to go, and then how we can be the vehicle to help them get there. And some of our clients are forever holders. So that's just not about transactions. We advise owners on during their hold period. Obviously, we can help them buy and sell real estate. And we feel we're very, very good. And I'm happy to get into the technicalities of the transaction. But when it comes to building relationships, it's putting ourselves in their shoes and truly trying to understand what's important to them, both in real estate and life, because a lot of times it's connected, and then figure out how to be the resource to help them get there. Even if that has nothing to do with the transaction, which a lot of times it doesn't, which is help them, advise them on operational efficiencies, keep them up to date on transactions in the market, new leases signed. A lot of times, like you said, I do net lease and shopping centers. So shopping center owners, it's very important to them as to when they get a vacancy, what some new leases are, who the tenants in the market, our thoughts and ideas on the type of businesses and services, the tenants that they can put into their centers. We have a phenomenal landlord leasing rep agent here in Tampa. So she's a great partner to help them with that, which just further strengthens our relationship. And I try to be I'm a very friendly guy and I enjoy being around people. And I'm also very good friends with a lot of my clients now. And that's this is all grounded, by the way, in my opinion, with genuine interest. Looking at them as people and not as dollar signs, going out to dinner, grabbing drinks, grabbing coffee, lunch, whatever it is you do for fun or they do for fun, and building that personal relationship. Because first, they got to check the box with you that you're good. So if they think you're good as a broker and a professional, and they like you as a friend, then it's very, very hard to infiltrate that relationship, because unless it's grounded with genuine interest and genuinely wanting to have a real relationship outside of just business, that's also something I don't think a lot of people have that they need, that in my opinion is very, very important to have these long lasting standing relationships. I think that was part of your question.
Yes, that absolutely is. And that just touches on, you know, yourself and then what you instill in your team. I think that making it go past the dollar signs, past the transactions, being that actual advisor and then genuinely caring about the person themselves, right? Going out to coffee or lunch or continuing that relationship, even if there's no deal to be done, so that when there is a deal to be done, you are the top of mind and you say, I'm going to call Ari and his team, you know, and make sure that you're right there because you actually care about the person plus the transaction that you're going to be doing. I think that's
great. I mean, there was a client earlier on in my Marks Millichap career that he was going to hold forever. And taking that approach and mindset, we still applied everything that I was taught combined with the attributes and that I had naturally as a person. And I got a call from him one day and he said he had cancer and he needed to sell because he didn't have kids and you can't split up buildings. So he wanted to sell, use the proceeds to leave them to his nieces and nephews. And because I had built this relationship with him for a long time prior, he had a lot of trust in me. He knew I was genuine and listed it with me at 8%. It was a smaller deal, even though there were other competitors saying they would do it for 6%. So when the rubber met the road and he knew he needed to transact and do something quickly at a high level, he looked past the money because he knew the genuine interest and authenticity was there and that I was good.
Absolutely. You know, that, and again, that's, you know, huge separator. So really, really appreciate you sharing that story. So how do you invest in your team's growth and set them up for success? So you mentioned on the prep call that we had before this, it's a great time to start in the industry. I know your first year was 2009. Can you share some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I was thankful I didn't know what was going on when I walked into the industry as a broker, because if I knew I was walking into a dumpster fire, I may not have done it. In hindsight, it was the best time to start. I talked to a lot of young/new men and women that are in the industry or newer to the industry. And the natural default is, man, I wish I would have started in a good market. So I can't say enough how important it is to start in a bad market, because you learn so much more. There are things that I'm doing on transactions this year that I really haven't even had to think about since 09, 10, 11, when transaction velocity was down, economy was challenging, so on and so forth. And learning those skills during a down market, let me rephrase, it's tough sometimes to learn those skills when it's like 2021. And all you got to do is put something on the market at the price the seller wants, and it transacts. You don't have to do the blocking and tackling and the fundamentals at as high of a level because the market's so strong. They're getting dead at 3%. So starting in 09, middle of 08, was the best thing that could have happened, because you're forced to do things, all the important, although albeit small things, got to do them with discipline and focus so you get that compound of success. And that's not quite as needed if you start in a market that's red hot. So
anyone that wants to start now. you'll learn a lot, you'll roll up your sleeves, you got to get creative, and then, you know, when everything is bouncing back, kind of easy peasy almost.
Yeah, and then you asked a question about how I handle my team, I'll go into that. Plus, my sole job for over 4 years is to recruit, hire, train, develop agents, Mark Similichat. So the way I address that with my team is I layer the message I just layered with you over and over again. That's a mindset. So it's, you get the mindset part, you got the technical fundamental part. Mindset's the most important. Without the mindset, without that elasticity of thought, without the resilience between your ears, then it doesn't matter what I teach you about the specific fundamentals of brokerage. And that's what I always try to do with my team. And when I was hiring and training people, is start with mindset, start with their goals, both for both personal and professional, because it all goes hand in hand, in my opinion. Get them clear on why they're doing what they're doing. Because when it gets hard, and it gets hard a lot over a long sustained period of time, having the resilience internally and mentally, two, really understanding why you're doing what you're doing is going to help push you through that and help you clear your brain to not focus on the unimportant, unhealthy thoughts on the mental side. So you have that full clarity to focus on what's important. And that's fundamental brokerage transactionally. That's approaching clients from an advisory standpoint. So I'd always get them to understand that first, and then constantly put them in uncomfortable situations. Not in a jerk type of way, although the first few months, handful of months of me, in my management career, I was thankful grateful that I had the mentor who hired me that I had, because he was in the office with me. And for the first handful of months, I wanted everyone to be like me. And I kind of approach it with an iron fist. He's like, look, man, if you keep this approach up, everyone will leave and you will have nobody to develop. He's like, everyone's different. Not everyone is you. And you got to figure out what makes them tick. You got to figure out how to deliver the message so you don't fog their brain with emotional thoughts about how you're being a jerk or how you said this or how you said that. And find a way to motivate them different. Find a way to clear their mind so they can focus on what's important for themselves. Because that's what we all care about in this world. No one cares more about, I don't care about anyone else more than I care about me and my family. And that's okay.
Yep.
You can be, I used to say selfish, but I use the word selfful now when it comes to this. You can be selfful and selfless at the same time. So similar to when I was a manager at M&M, my focus was the agents were my clients now. So I didn't focus about on me. I focused, if I did everything I could to do what's in their best interest, then everything I want to accomplish will be accomplished and then some. I'm a little different as a team leader, because as a manager at M&M, you're not a player coach. You're just a pure coach. Now I'm a team leader. I do have to transact and manage and develop people. So it's a little bit of a balance, because I have to be selfish in certain cases, because if I don't transact at the levels that I need to, I'm not going to be in the best position to help those around me. That also goes with team building. So I've changed my thoughts on team building over the years to where I don't want to just pile a bunch of people underneath me, because I know how much time, energy, and effort it takes to develop someone the right way. And I also know I have a limit to my capacity. So if I'm going and pushing beyond my capacity, I'm either letting the brokerage business drop, which I will never do that. Like, that's first and foremost, is my clients are owners of real estate. So that won't happen. So it falls on the mentorship side. And I can't allow that either, because these people, young, old, all new to the business, rely on me to help provide advice and guidance and mentorship and support to accelerate their career and put them in the best position to succeed. So I'm very thoughtful, and it's more of a slow burn on how I grow my team these days. For example, we had one guy who just soft launched. He was an analyst for the past couple of years. Now we backfilled him with a permanent analyst, and I don't plan on hiring anybody anytime soon, at least new people, because they're going to need a lot of my time. And unless I'm in a position to truly give that time to them, then it's unfair to both of us.
Absolutely. You said a ton there, and I love it. You're very intentional with your time. And I think that, you know, time is our most valuable resource and what we can give to one another. So being that player coach, you definitely have to balance a lot of different things. And I think one of the things that you touched on, whether or not our listeners out there have a mentor, is to understand their why. Right? Things will get hard, and it's, why do you keep going? Why do you continue to work hard? Where does the motivation come from? So I love that you're understanding that with the mentees, right, that you have, and then motivating them in that way. And going back to one of the original stories that you were saying, is understanding and delivering that message as well. So everyone is different. So you have to understand, whether it's your clients or whether it's the people that are under you on your team, delivering that message in different ways that's going to resonate with them. I think that's so powerful. So thank you for sharing that with us.
One more thing too is, this was also ingrained in my brain when I was a little kid, is respect. So sometimes it's easy for us to categorize people and in turn show a certain amount of respect one way or the other. So one thing I was always told is, whether someone's homeless on the street or the president of the United States, you treat them with the same amount of respect, which is the utmost amount of respect.
Yep.
So That's easy for me. I'm a pretty simple-minded thinker, which is, to me, that's black and white. Respect everyone, be polite to everyone, be nice to everyone, versus the opposite. Now, I certainly falter, and you know, we all have our faults, but anyone I talk to is grounded with that, no matter who they are. And I think that is an important lesson, not just in brokerage, but in general, at least it was for me.
Yep.
But it goes a long way. So people realize, because our clients and our team and people around us sometimes falter, and they may show a perceived sign of disrespect or say something that could be considered not very nice. And it's up to me on how I receive that. If you say something insulting to me, it's my fault if I'm insulted in my mind. I know I'm a kind of an extreme thinker, but if I allow you to insult, if I allow myself to feel insulted, then that's not on person saying it to me, that's on me. And In turn, if I allow myself to be insulted and then return the favor, then that's going to hurt my relationship with that person. You better be darn sure that you're ready to torpedo a relationship if you respond in emotion without respect.
Sure. You mentioned a point earlier, it's about managing what's in between your ears, and that's your mind and your emotions and how you react. And two quotes that came to mind just from what you were thinking is Eleanor Roosevelt, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent, right? So it's just how you're reacting to someone's comment, I think, is huge. And the second is from my dear mother. She said, you might not like me right now, but you will always respect me, right? And that was the first thing that she said, and something that's been ingrained in me for forever is just respect. So respect everyone, give that out, and then you'll get that, you know, in return. Or if not, just manage your emotions and say, okay, I'm not going to take that in this way. And I think that will go, you know, so far for you. So appreciate you sharing that, Ari. I want to get into the Tampa Bay market specifically. So I know you have expertise in single tenant net lease in Tampa Bay. So I want to dive a little bit into the current trends for our listeners. So to provide more context, can you explain the fundamentals of single and multi-tenant net lease assets for us?
Yeah, so single tenant net lease asset is a single structure occupied by one tenant that is under lease for a certain amount of time. Whereas shopping centers are typically multiple tenants under lease. So it's a very different product type, although there are synergies there. And That's the simplest way that I describe it.
That's perfect. Keep it simple for us. I think it's a KISS acronym, keep it simple, stupid. I love it. So briefly, what are some of the differences and similarities between single versus double versus triple net leases?
Sure. So on the single tenant side, it means something a little different in my mind than the shopping center side. So on the single tenant side, an absolute triple net lease, let's call it a Walgreens, for example. What that means is the owner of the real estate, the owner of the structure, virtually has very little to no responsibility. On an absolute triple net lease, Walgreens would be responsible for any capital expenses, responsible for real estate taxes, real estate insurance, common area maintenance, responsible for all those costs. On a triple net lease, some people call it double net lease, the owner of the real estate is typically responsible for, call it, roof and structure and parking lot. So some of those capital expenses, whereas a tenant would be responsible for real estate taxes, real estate insurance, and common area maintenance. And then on the shopping center side, the triple net lease, the tenants are responsible for taxes, insurance, CAM, and the owner of the real estate is typically responsible for the capital expenses like roof, structure, parking. And you got modified gross, which is a monthly payment. It's not just base rent plus CAM taxes insurance. It's a little simpler of a simpler way of doing it, where tenant pays one amount monthly, and that includes their rent, taxes, insurance, and CAM.
Perfect. Thank you for the overview. Very straightforward and easy for everyone to understand. So give us a 30,000-foot overview of your take on the net lease sector today. So how has it evolved? How has it changed over the last 5 years? What's still the same? Maybe touch on some mom-and-pop landlords that want more passive income. Give us kind of your 30,000-foot overview right now.
Yeah, so it really hasn't changed much from that standpoint. It's always been, it was the most resilient investment real estate product type during the Great Recession in 2009, because it's very simple. It's either that tenant goes bankrupt and vacates and stops paying rent, or they have to pay rent because they're under lease. A lot of investors like it because there's very little to no management requirements. So somebody that's used to owning a shopping center or multifamily or office building, they're used to constant management of those assets. And a lot of times these folks have been doing that for decades and they just want to relax and enjoy their lives. So they sell that, they 1031 exchange into a single tenant net lease asset where they have a lot less oversight and work to do on it. It's gotten a lot more popular, just like every other product type out there the last handful of years, with the economy so good and interest rates so low and everything going very well and all this, you know, additional cash that the Fed printed out the past 13 years. It's been really popular because it's also very simple. You have one structure, you have one lease, you have one tenant. Now you just got to figure out what that income is, how it's going to relate to the debt you get on that property. And then whose responsibility is what? And then single tenant net lease, landlords usually have very little to no responsibility. The way it's different today is year over year, year to date this year versus 2022 and 2021, the number of transactions that have closed have dropped like 60-70+%, even more in some cases, in some areas, in some product types. So it goes back to what I was saying before is focusing on the fundamentals, focusing on the commitment. Some people, you know, I heard over the summer that, you know, kicking back and relaxing a little bit until the summer opens back up and velocity down left and right. Sure, that's an approach. The other approach is doing the opposite. When things get tough, you double down, you work harder, and you position yourself to be, one, transacting during downtimes, but two, building those relationships, because just like good times, they will always end in the economy. Bad times will also always end. So if you double down during the bad times, build those relationships, not bad, but slower, double down on those relationships for when this does end, and you're going to be in a much better position to capitalize on that financially during the next run-up.
Could not agree more. And I love hearing that perspective. And just a reminder for all of our listeners to just continue to work hard, especially during those downtimes. Keep the foot on the gas, gas pedals on the right. So talk to us a little bit about what separates the Tampa Bay, West Florida market from the other sectors or the other areas, excuse me.
Yeah. So when you think Tampa, and I know I'm biased, born and raised, native here, but I think I'm also pragmatic in my thinking. So this may sound like me cheerleading, but I think it's the truth and the numbers kind of back it up as well. We'll start with Florida first. Pre-COVID, we had 1,000 people moving in a day. Post-COVID, at the height, it was 2,000 people moving in a day. Florida's always been an in-migration state. Can't replace sunshine and palm trees. Thankfully, we have leadership that's very business-friendly, no state income tax. So all those reasons, amongst many others, attracts a lot of people to move here and attracts a lot of investors to invest here because of that business-friendly approach. Now, going a little bit more micro to Tampa, is the biggest thing is, you know, cost of living. But we have the water. Unlike Miami, Fort Lauderdale, our cost of living is a lot less expensive. So that is also very important to people, especially as inflation has grown over the years and things are twice as much as they were a couple of years ago. That's important. And then look, sports are a big part of my interest. So I correlate a lot of things I do in life with sports, and Tom Brady certainly helped. I mean, you know, when the Lightning have been doing great, which is our hockey team. But when you get Tom Brady coming here, and we win a Super Bowl during COVID, it put us on the map even more. And there was actually a guy who ran, I believe, a hedge fund company out in California that relocated his whole company and headquarters to Tampa. And he said it was because he was here doing the Super Bowl, and he didn't realize how nice Tampa was. So till you come here, as long as it's not in the summer, you should have a great experience. because you got the water, you got a lot of stuff to do. If you live here, you don't have state income tax. You have more business friendly leaning environment, and cost of living here compared to other parts of this state, Southeast Florida to be specific, are appealing.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So that's awesome. And I know, Ari, you mentioned inflation. So what are some of the microeconomic or macroeconomic factors, such as inflation, rising interest rates, et cetera? How are such assets being affected by these conditions? So what's your short-term and long-term outlook for this sector and why?
I think Florida's insulated, although not impervious, mainly because of the way we handled the COVID, and that created a huge influx of migration, and the demographics of that migration post-COVID were more affluent, higher income demographics, which also certainly helps prop up our state economy because they're spending a lot of money, they're buying a lot of houses, so on and so forth. Candidly, in Florida, the main of people being affected at the moment are people that make money on transactions, because transaction velocity dropped significantly, or people that have issues with their debt. But most, if not almost all, the landlords I speak with in shopping centers, their occupancies are still all-time highs. They're not getting complaints from their tenants, which means business is going well, because the minute it stops, tenants will share those thoughts. And you know, I hesitate to share my short and long-term outlook because it is potentially not the outlook that others have shared historically with me this year. I kept hearing short and shallow, avoiding a recession, which I still don't understand, because long before I was alive and long after I'm dead, markets cycle. And during the down part of a cycle, it's a recession no matter what definition you want to give it. We can play smoke and mirrors with the technical definitions. But I don't think it'll be nearly as bad as 2009. And I hope I'm wrong, but I do think we're still in a challenging environment. The Fed's talking about raising rates again. Interest rates have a direct negative impact on real estate investment sales. And generally speaking, interest rate hikes don't truly take effect till 6 to 8 months after the hike. So I think we're going to continue to have challenges. But one thing I learned in 2009, challenges or transactions still occur. People were leasing, people were buying and selling, although less on the buying and selling side, and the brokers that understood this and didn't let the short-term pain affect the long-term journey, then they do great. But yeah, I mean, we're in a tough market. Anyone that says otherwise, that's their opinion. But that's what I'll say on that.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. So what are your primary considerations then as you're advising your clients in this condition that we're going through with the current economic conditions? What are you saying are the long-term upsides for them? What are some of the current obstacles? You know, how would you kind of advise someone in the net lease space right now?
Yeah, so it's all case by case. It depends what their goals are. So from a macro perspective, it's just be thoughtful. You know, it's understanding what their end term goals are. Some people want to make enough passive income so they can retire, understanding what they need on a monthly income to retire, and then align yourselves with them to figure out how much real estate they need at what certain percentage return, which will yield that amount of income to help them figure out if they can take their foot off their current job over time to focus more on, you know, retirement. Look, that being said, we've been transacting a good amount because people still need to sell. There are personal reasons people need to sell. So the advice I give to sellers is going to be custom depending on what their goals are. And one thing I can promise them is if they do decide to sell, that I'll be working my ass off for him night and day. These windows of opportunity with buyers are smaller and shorter because there's less buyers out there. And when you get somebody's attention, you got to capitalize on that, whether it's Saturday night or Sunday morning or Wednesday at 11 o'clock at night. You answer that call and you keep pushing the deal forward because there's not a line of buyers behind them. Every single deal we've closed this year, it took exponential more work, one, to get a buyer engaged, two, to keep the buyer engaged during contract to get them to close it. So, and there was no one behind that. A year and a half, 2 years ago, buyer starts acting up, you can say, go take a hike because I got six people waiting for you to fall out. That's not as much the case these days, yet still transactions are occurring. So it's about a high level of commitment, focusing on the fundamentals so you get better and better and more effective as an advisor and broker, and looking at clients and solely looking out for their best interest without having any concern for your own, knowing that if I take that approach, so it's my personal opinion, then good things will happen.
For sure. And I love your approach. I mean, you're hired from my perspective. So anyone on the call here or listening in on this, definitely Ari and his team are awesome. Now, a couple of things that you mentioned is transactions are still happening, right? Obviously, things are still taking place. It might be a little bit harder. You might need to put in a little bit more elbow grease, so to speak. So talk to our listeners about what the transaction volume looks like, what the velocity is, investor or seller sentiment, and then, you know, why an investor would consider a net lease asset in today's world, you know, what the pros and cons are. So a little bit of a two-faceted question, but if you can share a little bit more detail with our listeners, that'd be fantastic.
Sure. So from a seller side, we're working with developers, we're working with private individual owners, and they all have their motivations to sell. If a developer develops, then their ideal scenario is to sell, although they can still hold. But some of the developers I work with, they're not promising any transaction, even if we bring it to market. But I'm confident that the market today is going to be better than the market tomorrow. And in Florida, there's still a lot of demand, especially since COVID. Pre-COVID, a lot of investors were willing to invest in a lot of different parts of the country. Post-COVID, my experience in conversations are that a lot of investors were scared to invest, understandably so, by the way, in states that were overly cumbersome as it related to shutdowns. And then the extreme side, some states, maybe yours, were calling people murderers if they wanted to go to work or going outside. They were shutting down businesses. I have a buddy, a good friend of mine, who owns restaurants all throughout the country. And while Florida, Tennessee, Texas locations were doing well, his other ones in those other states were doing horrible. And it was a challenge. I was grateful every day that I lived in this state, although no one's perfect, no states are perfect. But I was grateful that I was able to go outside, work, provide for my family, and investors see that as well. So we still have a lot of demand in Florida relative to a lot of other parts of the country. And yes, most investors I talk to that are purely yield driven are not necessarily going to buy some of the stuff I have on the market. But there's a lot of other motivating factors as to why people buy real estate. And it's not purely yield. 1031 exchanges, super long-term holders that aren't looking just at the next 12 to 24 months, but the next 20 to 30 years. They look at the short, intermediate, and long-term horizon in Florida. On the single-tenant net lease side, even though we sell stuff all throughout the country, if you have a McDonald's or Chick-fil-A or something like that, you take that into consideration as to, you know, they're not, once again, if they have a 10-year lease or a 15-year lease, they still feel confident because they'll keep getting rent unless McDonald's goes bankrupt or Chick-fil-A goes bankrupt, Starbucks. So there's still a lot of motivating and driving factors for investors, even though there's some short-term headwinds.
appreciate all of that. And before we move into our third topic question, and if you don't want to share, that's okay. But any surprising or controversial thoughts on the current market that you'd like to share?
No, nothing that I haven't already shared. I think it's a slower market than a year ago. And I think we'll work through it like we did in 2009. I was still in college during the dot-com bubble burst, but worked through it then. And, you know, the people that are resilient will always work through it.
Absolutely.
Not that short-term pain.
So moving on to our third topic, Ari, given your specialized background and expertise, I'm sure our listeners are curious if you would answer a few rapid-fire questions and words of advice for us. So first one, if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would your go-to asset net lease type, location be, and why?
Do I only have to choose one? Because the advice would be to diversify the investments through shopping centers, multifamily, storage, and net lease, and industrial.
Any specific location?
In a tax-free state like Florida, Texas, and more importantly, in states that I'd have less concern when another crisis occurs in our country, that their leadership won't shut them down and further hurt the people and their and my investment selfishly.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Second question, what is your favorite net lease brand today and why?
I mean, that's a great question. Not as any brand with high credit. How's that?
That's perfect.
The Lowe's, anything that there's more reliability that income is viable, even during tough times. The less the credit, the less confidence I would have in the investment.
Of course. And then third rapid fire question, what is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
So the most biggest misconception is that what we do is, you know, like our parents or outsiders, they see the type of income that can be made here and they think it's filled with like bunch of boardroom meetings and you're dressed up in your suit and tie and you're talking to institutions and REITs and strategy and, you know, very polished white collar approach to a scope of work of business. Whereas the opposite, not completely the opposite, but there's a lot of pain, a lot of struggle, a lot of early mornings and late nights, a lot of calls where you get hung up on. And sometimes people on the other end of the line aren't very nice. Dealing with buyers and sellers all the time and being able to navigate not only your head, but their head as well to make sure you advise them in the best possible way to make a decision. And sometimes that decision is not to sell and being able to take yourself out of your own shoes and away from your own bank account to give that advice accordingly. Playing chess, not checkers, not worrying about the next move, but worrying about not just the next move, but 4, 5, 6 moves down the road. That is what I see the best brokers and how they approach the business execute. And I think that's a misconception. There's a meme I saw and it was like, what our parents think we do. And you're like standing there in a nice suit, you know, presenting to this group of executives, you know. What our friends think we do. Like if someone's making a lot of money, they're all flashy. And then like what you really do is similar to what I just said.
Yep, absolutely. I love those memes and it couldn't be more true. It's actually lifting up the hood and understanding all of the hard work, dedication, and just persistence that keeps going in this industry. So I couldn't have said it better myself, Ari. As we wrap up, any parting words that you'd like to share to our audience? Anything that you'd like to leave them with that you didn't already say?
No, not that I didn't already say. Just to reiterate, there's no better time to be in this business than now as a broker. And I know people will hear me say that, whether they're principals, whether they're brokers. I'm not talking about it as a principal, almost solely as a new broker. How's that? As a new broker, there's no better time. So let's edit that out. So to be clear, as a new broker, there's no better time to enter the market than now. Because presumably, for the most part, you don't have a high overhead. I know my monthly expenses when I was in my 20s, living, being able to live off ramen and whatever else I needed to live off of was very low. So if there's any time to make that sacrifice and learn today by maybe not making as much money as you could have 2 years ago, but it'll equip you with a mindset and a skill set to really build wealth in the future, then I'd encourage every new person that's thinking about getting in the business or just got into the business to flip a switch and have that mindset. Because the ones that do will flourish, and the ones that don't, they'll go to a different industry and they'll miss out on all this fun. So those are my parting words.
I love it. I love it. I think you've just convinced listeners who are on the fence to definitely go into brokerage. And if you're already there, lean in, right? Now is the time. It does work in down markets. Commercial real estate is cyclical. So I really, really appreciate all of the insights that you've shared today with me and our listeners. Ari, I know that you're super busy. We love that you took the time to sit down with us. If our listeners want to get in touch, they want to hear from you more, how can they connect with you? Social media, email, et cetera. Give it to us now.
Email is aravi@ripcofl.com. And my cell number is 727-452-6864. I don't have much social media personally, but I'm on LinkedIn is the main one I focus on from a business standpoint. So anyone can call me,
email me.
I'm always happy to help. If I don't call you back quickly, please don't take that personal. And if you're a new broker wanting advice and I don't call you back the first time, sometimes that's a test. So try me again. If you're a principal, that's not the case. I'll get back to you. Apologize in advance if it takes me, a few hours.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexy Podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexy. For video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.